Dr. Jeffrey Halstead has been Canandaigua's hometown dentist for more than 35 years, offering routine dental care as well as cosmetic dentistry, implants, and dentures by their highly trained and experienced staff. Visit them online at canandaiguadentistry.com or find them on Facebook and Instagram. For FingerLakes1.com, I'm Josh Durso, and this is Inside the FLX. Today we're talking with New York Times bestselling author Aphrodite Jones. After spending an hour with Jones talking career, the true crime space, and so much more, the only word that seems adequate to describe what she's achieved professionally is prolific. Her work has been featured on television and portrayed in movies. Jones has had her own television series and has plans for more in TV down the road, and most recently wrapped up a book about Carl Carlson. He's the man who's in prison for killing his son in Seneca County, as well as his first wife in California. Jones spent nearly 2 years interviewing Carlson from prison and the killer's second wife, Cindy. Her book, Levi's Eyes, dives deep into the case that many in the Finger Lakes feel like they know inside and out. But as Jones describes, that couldn't be further from the truth. We pick up the conversation with Jones describing the early days of her career and how true crime found her.
Sure, of course. I know exactly how this started. So I was living in Appalachia in Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky. I was a professor at a small college there. And I was working on the radio as a announcer on the side. And I was the news director for a radio station in Pikeville, Kentucky. And at that time, there was an FBI agent who killed his informant slash lover. She was pregnant, threatening him to go to the FBI, go to his wife and reveal her pregnancy. He killed her. He had to lead the local police to her bones, months later. Name is Mark Putnam. And at the time, I was reporting it on the news, the radio that I was the news director of, and I couldn't believe, where's CNN? Where's everybody? This is the only FBI agent in history that went to prison convicted of murder. He copped a manslaughter plea, but he's guilty of murder. He went to prison. Why didn't nobody from the news hear? I know I'm in Appalachia at the end of the world, but, you know, in any event, it spurred me to want to write a book because I realized, having been a part of that community for many years, that, you know, these, quote, hillbilly people weren't being paid attention to. And Susan Daniels Smith, who was first missing and later realized that she had been killed, her family, her sister, had a fight for every moment of justice because they didn't believe her. They didn't care about this young woman who was missing. In any event, I cared. I decided to write the book. I got the rights to the family. They cooperated with me, worked with the FBI. They kind of stonewalled, but I was able to get through somewhat. The book came out called The FBI Killer, and it was made into a television movie with Patricia Arquette playing the victim. It was a big ABC movie of the week back then, yeah, and then aired on Lifetime for years. That then turned me into my next book, or that then spurred my next true crime book. The movie that followed that is called Boys Don't Cry and launched the career of Hillary Swank. So, there I am writing true crime stories.
And it's been quite a ride. Obviously, today we're talking about Levi's Eyes, which is local for us here in upstate New York and in the Finger Lakes. I want to talk process about that. Like, how did that particular project start for you? And I guess when it comes to any of these stories, how does an author like you find a story like that? Does it get suggested numerous times, or is it something that you kind of like are keeping your eyes out for all the time?
Well, remember, I did 6 seasons of my show. So I did 63 episodes. And within all those episodes, there are various stories that I felt were worthy of a book, on the Carl Carlson being one of them. The reason I went with that story is because by the time I was ready to do that and write a book again, as it turned out, the his wife had been killed in a fire in California, and there had never been any adjudication of that. So when I did this story for my show for ID, and at that time he had just gone to prison for having admitted to causing the death of his son, Levi. And that was the whole story. But I knew in the backdrop of that, that his first wife, Christina Carlson, was killed in a fire. So we all kind of knew he's guilty of this, but is he going to get tried for it? Are they going to find enough evidence? The case hadn't been, you know, dealt with in almost 25 years. And when I found out that, oh my God, there's going to be a trial, they're trying him, they've extradited him, now I'm waiting for that, because I went out and covered that trial in 2020 before the pandemic, January and February of 2020. And of course, I was calling Carl and on the jail phone for almost a year. And then it became another year after the sentence was over, so that I had this incredible access to this monstrous killer. Typically, no killer would talk to you before or during a trial, but he did, because he is an absolute monomaniac.
I was going to say that part of it kind of feels a bit unique, the access that you had. What is that like? You know, you write in the book that you're speaking to this person on a daily basis. You're probably talking to him more than most anybody. What is that like? And then what kind of insight do you get to a person like that, that perhaps you're not typically getting from like news coverage or even what's happening in like actual court proceedings as those are playing out?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it's very rare to get that kind of access to a killer. Extremely rare. None of them want to talk. Certainly not before a trial. And then even after that, the appeal, they want to tell you, you know, they're hesitant to talk. Having that kind of access is the first time I had that access in 30 years of doing this. In terms of getting into Carl's head, I was able to get into his head. I don't know that I was able to portray fully in the book how much he was, felt like an odd duck. He felt like a black sheep. I mentioned it, I believe, but his whole life was about living up to his siblings, about living up to his father's standards, and he couldn't do it. And so now he decides maybe he needs to have some misfortune with life insurance so that he can say, I'm a hero, I saved my kids. And by the way, now I'm getting $200,000, so I'm buying a house, et cetera, et cetera. So that's part of what was behind there. But obviously, someone who's willing to kill their wife and possibly their kids has a lot more than just trying to live up to their brother and father's expectations.
Yeah, I guess when you're approaching something like this, you had obviously some exposure to this. You were exposed to the case. You're kind of covering the case as a reporter would in some ways, except 1,000 times more in depth. Do you come into it with kind of like a game plan of where you think it's all going to lead in terms of what a book might look like? Or do you approach it kind of in a almost like an investigative way, the way law enforcement wouldn't just kind of like let the details take you where they may?
It's a two-pronged approach. So I have a specific outline of what it is that I'm going to talk to him about. But obviously we go off into tangents, and he's great at doing that, by the way. But I have to pull him back. But some of those tangents were, you know, the pearls of insanity that came out of his mouth. I quote quite often in the book things that he said that are just unfathomable, you know, just and that all happened because he started to let go of his masks, let his guard down, and tell me things that he realized, oh, maybe I shouldn't. And there's a couple things he tried to walk back, including the fact that he killed 8,000 ducks with his bare hands. And then the next day when I spoke to him, he's like, you know, I didn't want to do that, but it was for their benefit because I couldn't let them starve to death. Yeah, but we could have used carbon monoxide and put them down rather than killing each one by the neck, one by one. I didn't ask him why. You know, those are places you don't want to go with a monster / psychopath.
Yeah. How do you walk that line? Because I would imagine it's something that you're dealing with on a daily basis when you're talking that, like, are there certain guards you have to put up, or how do you contend with that? Because it seems like it could be something where, you know, 1 minute you're on the rails, and then all of a sudden he's off the rails and you're hearing things or talking about things that perhaps, you know, you didn't really want to sit down for.
Right. Well, you know, when you have the luxury of talking that often and that much, because it's 15 minute in intervals, but we would do four of them. So we do at least an hour, 5 days a week, sometimes more. And so you have the flexibility, if you will, to let him go off on his tangents and find a way to follow those tangents to see what is in this guy's mind. Because there's a reason he's going on a tangent. Now, oftentimes it's because he wants to show you he's not guilty. But as the more time that you're spending in discussing the person's life, the more you're seeing, like I say, the mask coming off somewhat. And the way I walk that line is you got to let them think you're on their side. Otherwise, they don't want to talk to you. But at the same time, whenever he's giving me a bizarre explanation or he's tripped himself up, I catch him on that, you know, and it's all recorded and for the purpose of the book. And he gave permission for me to use it any which way. So eventually I would like to edit some of these tapes together so you can hear this bizarre man, you know, tripping over himself and trying to explain away things that can't be explained.
5 days a week, an hour plus at a time, over the course of 2 years, while he's also going through litigation himself. How do you decipher truth from not truth, or perhaps stretched truth? And how much harder is that with someone who is obviously not stable and clearly a psychopath, among other things?
So to tell you the truth, Josh, you can't really distinguish what's real and what's not real unless you have other people to bounce it off. So I had his second wife, Cindy, who's the one that wore a wire and trapped him, who I could bounce all these things off and say, you know, Carl was talking about a dog that died. What happened there? And she'd start saying, no. That dog was caught under one of his wagon wheels and he built wagons. And, you know, I believe he did it on purpose, you know, things like that, where he would say, you know, I did what I could with the animals on my farm and I love animals and blah, blah. Then you find out, no, he doesn't love animals. He's neglecting his horses. And of course, we know that he burned the barn up and killed his beloved Ginger, big, huge female mare that he was so proud of. So there's no, it's interesting. When I let him keep going and I ask him about the fire and we get into all the details, now he's telling me he's not guilty. And of course, I'm double checking. I know he's guilty. And through his wife, Cindy, I know exactly how this went down, what games he played. But the interesting thing is he'll then say things like, you know, when the insurance company got here, they wanted to see how many horses were dead and what happened, what it was. And I told them they're buried in the backyard already. So if you want, go get a shovel and dig them up. And later he says, I dug them up. Now, did he really do that? I don't know. No way to check that.
Yeah.
But the fact that he even mentions it, like he's into digging things up from the grave. It's,
Obviously, that's a great segue into another angle of this that I wanted to talk with you about. Obviously, his second wife, integral to the book, obviously really important to your process and how you were able to bounce ideas and everything like that off of her with what you were hearing from Carl. I'm curious, what was that like? What was the perspective to kind of see both, get both sides of the curtain, so to speak, but then also to hear some of the things from her that I would imagine not a lot of people have heard before?
Right. So she admitted to a lot of things. She admitted to her alcoholism and the drinking and how she tried to drown this out. She talked about not wanting to believe that Carl could have been responsible for any of this, but that she had this, you know, this constant nagging for years. Because remember, you may not know, but she had a child with him, Alex. And now she's had this child with him. So she doesn't want to think that this father of her only child is a killer. I mean, that's the last thing she wants to think. So it took her years to come to the realization that this guy is, he did these things. She kept running over in her mind over and over again that she heard country music playing on the radio in the day that Levi died. And Levi was a heavy metal kid. He was not into country music. So it started to bother her that why was there country music on that day? Who would have put that channel on? Well, the only person who would have put it on is Carl, because he's the only other one that was there on the premises. Things like that sort of eat away at her. And she ultimately went to a private eye and then discovered that he had taken out annuities with death benefits on her that would equal $1.2 million if she was dead. So she was going to be next. Comparing what she said to Carl became interesting because her perspective of him was he was such a talker and a great talker. He could talk his way into and out of anything. And it got to a point for her where if she'd catch him in a lie about his money he'd spent from Levi's funds, et cetera, and he'd have 82 explanations and he could bring it around in a circle to the point that she was confused. She didn't know what to think.
Yeah.
And he's very good at that, Carl. He's very good at that. The only way that you know it isn't true is after the fact. I come in with the 2020 vision after the fact, right? When he's being tried for his first wife's death, after he's been, you know, copped a plea to his son's death, so that I'm not having the same perspective as, say, Cindy was when she doesn't want to believe it. She doesn't want to believe it, and you can't blame her. When she starts to believe it, she starts to drink. And when she starts to drink, he's now using that against her. And that turns her stepdaughters against her. And, you know, also to some extent, even her own son, Alex, against her. Because now they're blaming her. Because Carl, again, is good at shifting the blame, making it her fault. She's the one who spent all of Levi's money. Truth is, Carl's the one who wanted to spend all that money. He was the only one named in the will. He was the one who went and got the insurance policy with Levi. And he was the only beneficiary. But he put Cindy's name on those accounts so that he could blame her.
Yeah. I would imagine you got to see a bit of, through her own words, perspective shift, like what you're describing, over a course of many, many years. I'm curious where you felt like that left her the last time you spoke with her as you're going through, you know, wrapping things up with the book.
Well, first of all, we became close. So we're still close. I mean, we obviously don't talk every day, anything like that, but we check in with each other, texting, et cetera. Luckily for Cindy, Alex got married and they just had their first child, he and his wife, and a boy. And so Cindy is now a grandmother again. And, you know, she lost her two grandchildren, the children of Levi, because of money issues with that part of the family. And now she's got a grandchild and she's got, you know, her life in order, so to speak. And so as she told Piers Morgan, we did an interview live with him when the book first was released. And she said, it's all good now. And, you know, it's never going to be all good, but it's certainly her life she's extracted herself for the most part from the Finger Lakes. She's still there part time, but because she felt like she was ostracized by the community because, you know, the way Glenn Coyne covered this story, for example, in Syracuse.com, always left the door open to show that she was guilty, always left the door open to show that she also participated in getting the money from Levi's insurance, life insurance, and that she kept that money and she used it for herself and she never gave anything to her granddaughters, Levi's daughters, and it made her look like a monster. And nobody believed anything other than that. And I found it bizarre, Josh, when, if not for Cindy Carlson, who went after Carl, who started to believe that Carl killed her stepson, his son. And she's decided on her own to wear a tape recorder and start meeting with him. And remember, she finds out that he's got a life insurance or annuities, death benefits on her, and she's sleeping with a killer. I mean, can you imagine sleeping? I just did a piece on the Gilgo Beach serial killer on Long Island. And as much as we have discovered about Rex Heuermann, the truth is his wife was also a swinger and she was in the house when things were going on, not killing, but weird stuff, okay? Bondage, who knows, all right? If I could get, people have asked, will you do that story? The answer is, if I could get to that wife and get that inside of that house, I wouldn't be able, I would be running to do that story. But you're not, she's not going to talk. However, in this case, I had Cindy Carlson, and she's willing to tell me what's going on the inside of that house. And she told me this for years. I worked with her for the same amount of time as I worked with Carl, because the longer I'm talking to Carl, the longer I have to double check with her and cross check. So it was a very interesting experience to have that, you know, access to both of them.
When you're covering something so dark for such a long period of time, is there like a feel good moment for you when something like you're describing now, Cindy's grandmother again, and she's kind of clear of everything that's happened in the past, and she's able to live like quasi normal life now, I suppose. Of course, there's going to be baggage, right? But like, does that make you, give you something, I guess, to feel good, to take away from an otherwise really kind of dark, depressing topic?
Right. So let me explain my creed, for lack of a better word. I'm there to shed light on a dark situation so that somebody out there might be able to notice some signs about it in their own life and say something, do something, rather than just letting it devolve. That's one. Number two, the persons that I'm interviewing, as I'm interviewing them, what I'm hoping for is catharsis with them. So there's a lot we talk about that has nothing to do with going into a book. It's recorded, but there's nothing to do with anything really about the story. And the reason I do that is because, and I let people know, it's important that your story be told so it can help other people. But the truth of the matter is, how many murders are out there that nobody covers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we countless. We can't, I mean, if you add them all together, I get approached every single day, Josh, with another murder case through my website, if not one, two, three. Or it's, you know, my son was murdered. They called it suicide. It wasn't suicide. My daughter was, you know, found guilty of this. She didn't do it. My husband, it's constant. All right. And on these, all of these murders, for the most part, they don't have the legs, as we call it in the business, to fulfill an entire book or even an hour on Dateline or even an hour on my show, because there's an easy answer to who did it, you know?
Yeah.
Or it's obvious, or they caught the criminal right away. It was the husband, things like that. So that even though the murder can be a horror story and usually is, if you know who did it, there's nothing story to tell. So what I try to explain to people who I do interview is that your story can make a difference. And in a sense, it matters that you're able to tell this story and get through it, not just for your benefit, and perhaps you'll be able to live, you know, a little easier if you talked about it, but because most people don't get that opportunity.
Yeah.
They have a murder in the family and no one talks about it, or no one cares in the outside world, in the media world.
Yeah. Some submitted questions that I want to get to. First, how do you take care of yourself, not just as you're going through these individual projects, but across the board? This is a career for you. This is your every day. You're getting requests every single day. Saturday and Sunday probably hit a little different for you than it does for most people who have a 9-to-5 working in an office. So talk to me a little bit about that process for you. Like what is disconnecting, if you can even do that? Like how does that work on your end?
Well, you see, I'm smiling, right? So when I wrote the book Cruel Sacrifice, which is now 30 years ago, hard to believe, I was so entangled with that story that I really began to be in a place where I wasn't brushing my teeth. Forget about showers. I was just rolled into that story and yeah, having nightmares and all of it. And that's when I realized, okay, when that book was done, I promised myself, first, I didn't want to write true crime books anymore. And as I said to you, I got stuck in that category. But also, no matter what I was going to be doing in writing and dealing with true crime stories, that I would put that to sleep by 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then do my running, jogging, things I do, go out at night, be a different person, and never work on the weekends. So I work about 7 to 4-ish every day, and then not on the weekends. And then I become a different person. I have my other life. And I had to make that distinction many years ago, because as I said, I got so embroiled in the story of Cruel Sacrifice and the horrors of that story are beyond comprehension. Frankly, I don't talk about it because it's horrifying. And so I have to just cut it off. Otherwise, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I have to shut it off.
Yeah.
So I have a very busy social life. I'm a big, you know, I'm a runner. I'm a person who lifts weights. I'm into that whole thing. I just have a different life. I have two lives.
Yeah. Sounds like you could write a book on work-life balance, which everybody could benefit from reading. Another one coming up here. What was the most surprising or interesting thing that Carl said to you over the course of the many, 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 many hours that you talked to him?
Oh my God. He said, and I quoted in the book, that Levi wasn't good enough for his wife, Cassie. Now, this is after he admits to having left his son under a truck and having let his son die this horrible death. And he is now going to berate his son and talk about the fact that he wasn't good enough, when prior to that, all he did was trash Cassie. So there's a lot of trashing that goes on out of this guy's mouth. And then all of a sudden he forgot all about that. So for example, and I didn't put it in the book because Cassie's a victim and I try not to re-victimize victims, even though I didn't speak with her, et cetera. He went on and on about how filthy these kids were, and they would come to the house, to the farm every weekend, and in filth, and their clothes were filthy, and their diapers weren't changed, and body, body, body. And he went on and on about this on a regular basis. What a horrible wife Cassie was, a gold digger, yada, yada. That's why Levi left his life insurance money to Carl, because he didn't want Cassie to have it, because Cassie would just spend it on garbage. Not spend it on her kids, that she was this awful, awful mother. And yet after all these months of telling me about this, at some point it comes out of his mouth that, you know, really Levi wasn't good enough for Cassie. Like, what? That's something that'll always stay with me, because it's just the depravity of his mind. And then the other thing I will say, again, that this is in the book, is that when Levi was in the hospital, dead on arrival, and Carl went into the room with Levi to cry and hold Levi's hand and the whole little scene he created by himself in there, Cindy finally went in to that room, the private room, and he hands her, look at this. Here's Levi's piercings. You don't want to know where these came from. And of course, then he lets her know one of them came from Levi's penis. Like, really? You're next to your son's corpse. Your wife, the stepmother of this young man that she's taken care of since he's 6 years old, 5 years old. It, really? Like, she needed to know this? But that's how twisted. First of all, what was he doing at his son's penis taking out a piercing? And who knows how true, where, what? I mean, it's just craziness.
Yeah. When you're interviewing or researching killers, do you find a common thread that kind of interweaves itself in a lot of them? You've obviously talked to plenty of them. One of the things that we saw pretty commonly in terms when we were outreaching for questions for this interview was a lot of people assume, maybe right or wrong, that there are a couple common themes among people who do these heinous things. Any truth to that from your experience, or is it a case by case? Every individual is their own unique mess.
It's a combination, honestly, but there are traits and elements that I have pinpointed and seen. And one of them, the biggest one, is the killing of animals. So that the various stories I've done on, for example, The Embrace, which is about teenagers who killed the girl's parents in Orlando, Florida. They, Eustis is the town outside Orlando. That young man, who was 16 at the time he murdered this girl's parents, had grown up, and the grandmother got on the stand to say, "My grandson is the sweetest boy. He's always cared about everything. And when he was little, he dug a fish up from the backyard that was buried so that he could bring it to me and show me that he wanted the fish, you know, not to be stuck under the ground." Okay. Right? Right there. Boom.
Okay.
Okay. So you have this twisted sensibility of people who are capable of killing, of being into it, and you see signs of it from the time they were younger. You know, I have seen that as a thread in cases where it's a plotted out murder, not, you know, not snapped, not crime of passion, but when it's plotted out and when it's carried through, and oftentimes then they murder again, right? This starts at a younger age. And, you know, so Carl killed animals, Rod Farrell in The Embrace killed cats and hung them from trees. Just bizarre things that went on prior to him having killed the human being. So that it does give you an insight into their head.
Biggest unresolved question in your mind after you got done with this particular book, if there was anything that kind of still lingered afterward?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think so, because I've really spent so much time researching this. This was the most involved book that I've ever written. In other words, I mean, I spent 4 years with this book. Typically, it'll be 1 to 2, 1 year, 1.5 years. This was 4 years. This was a mountain that I had to climb. And in so doing, I don't think there's anything that I really left out or didn't have an answer to in my mind. Now, there is one big question at the end of this book, and that is, and the beginning of this book, and that is, what did Levi see? Which is why I called it Levi's Eyes.
Yeah.
Because we will never know what Levi saw the day of that fire. We will never know. But it's my presumption, based on the stories and the interviews from by police and the DA and everyone else that are tape recorded with Carl, that Levi could have gotten out on his own, and that Carl put him in the car, and Levi watched and realized that his father wasn't planning on saving not only his mother, but his sisters either.
Yeah. When it seems like when these types of stories are told, there's at least somewhat of an assumption that, you know, you mentioned killing animals. It seems like there's also an assumption, perhaps right or wrong, that there could be other human victims. Is that kind of a misnomer when it comes to these types of things, or do you have to enter it with the idea that potentially this, the person you're the subject of your work, could potentially have done other terrible things as well that, you know, police and everybody else doesn't know about?
Of course, you always have that thought, no question. You know, but when it comes to somebody who's, for example, killing for insurance money, like Carl Carlson, and there's many murders like that, you kind of realize that greed is what's at the backside of this. Yeah. And if there was anyone else that they benefited from, you know, I'll give you an example. I wrote a book about Michael Peterson. Called A Perfect Husband. That story became the Netflix documentary, The Staircase. And it was all from Michael Peterson's perspective. Well, Michael Peterson not only had his wife in Durham fall down the stairs, but also 16 years prior in the 1980s, his friend, best friend, fell down the stairs in Germany and died. And Michael Peterson was the only one there to find her. And he inherited her two daughters, which he later claimed, you know, he's doing them a favor by having to get these two daughters. No, actually, the daughters came with money. And actually, the woman that fell down the stairs that he insisted he didn't kill and was never investigated, so it's never been proven, he killed her. How simple is that? He killed her. And there's witnesses who testified at the trial that they saw blood spatter leading up to the ceiling in that house in Germany. You know, that doesn't happen because somebody fell down the stairs. But that was the first time. Now, what happened before that? He claims he killed people when he was in Vietnam or when he was in the war. I don't know. Yeah. He claimed he had a Purple Heart. He wrote twisted novels about murder and bisexuality and homosexuality. I mean, there was so much in this guy's head that you can't believe, frankly. So that there's other stuff there, out there, often.
Last question for you. What's next? What are you working on now? Are you taking a break now that your Levi's Eyes is out and available?
Yeah. So I took a little bit of a break. However, of course, I have to do promotions. So there's not a true break, although right now I'm kind of in the midst of. But what I'm going to start to do is record audiobooks, because everybody wants now the audiobooks. So I'm going to start with Levi's Eyes. And then I have 8 books total to release as Audible for Audible. One of my books, Michael Jackson Conspiracy, I had someone else narrate it whose voice is very close to mine. And that's all well and good, but they can't get the accentuations the way I wrote it. So it took me a lot of time with that narrator, who was fantastic, to get her to redo things with the appropriate accent on certain words and, you know, the way that I speak, the way that I tell the story. So now I'm going to do it. And that's a huge undertaking, Josh, because I read one book years ago, Red Zone, and it was so long ago that it was on cassettes. But I remember when I did it and I was in a studio in LA, I did it in 2 or 3 days and they were shocked, because they said, you know, we have actors that come in, Julia Roberts, whomever, to do voiceovers, and they take way more time. I think now it is going to take me longer, because I am more, I don't know, versed in narration because of my television show. And I understand the importance of where you accentuate things, where you don't. Repeating voices in conversations is something new for doing in a book. So I'm ready to get started with that. I'm very excited about it, because I want people to hear the books.
Yeah.
You know, it's my way of reintroducing my books to a new audience in a way, because most of them written so long ago. The other thing I'm doing is, of course, I will work on a treatment for a film based on Levi's Eyes. We'll see where that goes. And I'm going to be at CrimeCon this year, where I will be speaking about the Michael Peterson case and the Steer case, along with people that were involved in that story. So that's exciting. And, you know, I've been asked to speak at other events as well, which I've done all my career. But on top of all of that, I will be starting either some kind of podcast or blog, and I want to start a true crime group online. So, I mean, I'm not sure exactly, but one of the things I really want to do, Josh, is I want to create something that's going to help victims, families. And in order to do that, I feel the thing to do is I want to create a series of tapes with some subliminal messaging that can perhaps help maybe not only victims of crime, but people who feel they're victims of whatever. So that I don't want to, it's not like I'm going to be going in there and saying, you know, you need to forget about your son being murdered, you know, or let's move on to something. No, but there's a way to give people, I hope, to figure out that they're re-victimizing themselves by reliving this drama and trauma. And it's always going to be there, but you don't have to feed into it. You know, don't lean into it. Find a way to find some joy in your life, because if someone has killed a loved one, they've victimized you. But if you continue to think about it and go into that victimization, you're re-victimizing yourself. Mm-hmm. And they've now gotten away with not only taking your loved one's life, but your life too. So there's a lot of times, Josh, when I was interviewing people for my show, where people would say to me at the end of an interview, thank you, because you let me release something.
Yeah.
And the person that's a perfect example of that is O.J. Simpson's manager, who felt guilty that somehow he was responsible in getting O.J. to, you know, not have to answer to things. And I, you know, I cover that on my show pretty well. And his name is Mike Gilbert. And Mike and I are very close to this day, because he felt that I gave him that permission to forgive himself, because he really didn't do anything. He didn't do this.
Yeah.
You know, OJ went to him after the fact and said, let's sell all my stuff in the house. So, you know, Mike did stuff like that. But No, you know, so I think the catharsis and trying to get, so that's something I really, really intend to do. The question is, at what point will I do it? Is it going to be a year from now? Is it going to be later this year? Depends how long it takes me to get through these audiobooks. And then, you know, of course, I have a new TV thing in mind. So it never ends.
It's a long list. It's a long list. Aphrodite, thanks so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Josh. It was a pleasure.